So this Advent, we've been learning, as our screen says, to say no to the culture of now through learning to unplug in various ways, through silence and solitude and living what I coined last week. I think I might have coined a word, leading a Sabbathed sort of life. So removing ourselves, though, as we're finding from our normal connected lives of production and consumption, can actually be very unnerving and scary, and it's probably the surest sign of all that we need it. When being unplugged and being disconnected brings on a little panic attack, it's probably the surest sign that you could use to be unplugged for a bit. Found some stats this week. From a latest study, I don't remember who did this one, but 84% of people say they can't go a day without their phone. 80% of young people, so this is like 18 to 30, sleep with their phone like we used to sleep with a teddy bear. They like sleep with their phone. Now the average person checks their phone 150 times a day. On an average of every 4 to 6 minutes. Now, I'm sure that includes things like seeing what time it is and stuff, but nevertheless, 150 times a day. So have you heard there's a new movement? It's called the National Day of Unplugging. It's not a Christian movement. It's a, I don't know what it is, just a regular old movement. I'm happy for it. Here's their pitch. This is their pitch, not mine. Do you have multiple cell phones? Do you take your iPad to the beach on vacation? Ever find it hard to get through a conversation without posting an update on Facebook? Is your computer always on? And then the pitch goes on to say, we increasingly miss out on the important moments of our lives with our noses buried in our phones, chronicling every move through Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, shielding ourselves from the outside world with the bubble of, quote, silence that our earphones create. So if you look through their website, they suggest these, they have a 10-point manifesto for unplugging. Here it is. Avoid technology, connect with loved ones, nurture your health, get outside, avoid commerce, light candles. Here's one some of you'll like. Drink wine, eat bread, find silence, and give back. Tom Carman and I were commiserating this morning. I'm sure Dennis and there's other teachers in this room were all been grading papers the last week. And I was reading one of my students' papers from the class that Beth and I teach on spiritual formation. And I want you to hear what she said. She said, this is probably a 20-year-old girl. The rise of social media makes us feel like everyone needs to know everything that we're doing and that we need to know what everyone else is doing, so that we can show that our lives are just as interesting, meaningful, cool, and spiritual as others. And then she introduced me to something. Like, this is a classic case. This is why some of us like teaching, because you might not know it, but we learn often as much from our students as they do from us. And this is one of those sort of classic moments where she says, in fact, my generation has this new saying, and it kind of expresses why complete solitude scares us so much. There's this new acronym called FOMO. Now, don't worry, it's okay. I know we're not used to acronyms with the F letter in it that are okay, but this one's actually benign. It's the fear of missing out. And this is what drives so much of the mania of our lives, whether it's facilitated by social networking or just the own considerations of our inner thoughts. And so we've been reading this Brueggemann book together this week, and or this Advent, and one of the things that Brueggemann said in the latter chapters of this book is that coveting or covetousness in the biblical tradition includes both an attitude of craving, right? You have to have that. We all get that. There's this attitude of craving. But there's also attached to it a forceful action to secure that which is craved. Otherwise, what's the point? But we have now this increasingly sort of forceful desires to connect with everything, and we think we like it, and we call it, you know, in its benign form, multitasking. And again, here I think Brueggemann's very helpful, where he says, actually, multitasking is the drive to be more than what we are, to control more than we presently control, to extend our power and our effectiveness. And Brueggemann says, I think rightly, such practice yields a divided self, with full attention given ever to nothing. I mean, some of you who know me well enough to know my kind of weekly rhythms know that often I try to only work about a half a day on Friday, and then I go home, and that's typically when I get serious about sermon prep, and then also on Saturday mornings. Well, I've come to just crave Friday afternoons. I love them. And it always cracks me up with the young church planters I coach all over America. You know, trust me, ministers in their 20s are scared to death of sermons and scared to death of having to give them and prepare for them and blah, blah, blah. And I love Friday afternoons because it is the only time in my life often when I can give myself to a single focus. So it feels like a privilege to just sit with a text and to have nothing to do but think about this text. And think about what this text is saying to me and what this text might be saying to us and what God was doing through this text and how this text can somehow make coherence of our lives. It is such a rich privilege to give full attention to something because it's so rare these days. And it seems like what undergirds this for so many of us is this really big need to get more out of life. It's like we have this feeling that if I had more or did more, that this would give me a sense of well-being, that this would give me what everybody in the Western world at least would agree to is the good life. But Jesus said that the one living the good life, like if you were to ask Jesus, if he were to just stand up from the front row today and stand here and I interviewed him and I said, Jesus, what comprises the good life? Of what is the good life consist of? He would say, anyone alive in my Father's kingdom and giving themselves to me as an apprentice. Jesus would say, that comprises the good life. Anyone alive in my Father's kingdom and rule and living under his rule and reign, that person is living the good life. And this then begins to give us a sneak peek about what happens when the rule and reign of God presents itself to a young girl who is at least alert enough to hear it and then utter these magical words. I mean, to me, these are some of the most beautiful words in the whole Bible. It's very hard for me to think of more beautiful words that come from a human being in the Bible than these. Behold, I am. This is my sense of myself, this young woman says. This is my sense of what the good life could be comprised of. I am the servant of the Lord. And just let it be to me according to your word. I am ready to serve. I'm ready, Mary says, in, you know, maybe more modern language, to be an active, willing partner in this holy disruption of my life. This is a bit of a disruption, Lord. A little bit. This sort of prefigures Al Gore's, this is sort of an inconvenient truth, Lord. But as I said, these are for me some of my favorite words in the whole Bible because they give me an imagination for like a model interior life and what an interior life could look like. And actually, Mary, not just for Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox, but for the vast sweep of Christian thought, Mary is actually meant to be for us for everything else she is concerning the birth of Christ, with reference to the church, she's meant to be for us an example right at the beginning of the Jesus story, before he calls the 12. Before he starts rebuking Pharisees or Sadducees or teachers of the law or Herodians or zealots or whatever, before he starts choosing off the Jews of his day, there stands this towering figure in human history, Mary. This young girl who is a towering figure because of the model of her interior life. Where else can you see such pure yielding, such pure letting go of the devices and methods that we all employ to have pseudo control of our lives. I can't imagine I'm telling you anything that you don't already know when I say, you know, you actually don't have control over your life, right? Right? I mean, as hard as you're trying and you get the flu, right, during finals week. Or as hard as you're trying to diligently manage and control your life, things spring up and we actually don't have control, but we're willing to pay almost anything for pseudo control, for the sense of control, and very rarely stopping to ask, what price am I paying for pseudo control? And the question that exists on the other side of that coin, what kind of life might be available to me in that pure yielding that we see right at the beginning of this story in Mary? So in that sense, Mary sits in church history as a model of the church, a model of what it means, the priesthood of all believers. Mary is an icon of what Jesus meant when he said, when you pray, pray thy kingdom come, thy will be done. But let's just take a minute and wonder together, well, where does this impulse in Mary come from? Well, we can't actually know much about Mary. In this text, we see that Mary's called favored. She's perplexed. She's thoughtful. She's afraid. She questions. She believes. And then she submits to her vocation saying, I'm ready to serve. But beyond that, we don't know much about her. She lived in an out-of-the-way town. She didn't live in cool, hip, cosmopolitan Jerusalem, you know, sort of the New York City or LA of her day. In a sense, you can say that what the Bible says to us about her, it says mostly silently. And what it silently says is that Mary has nothing and is nobody. That really what she is a young woman. I want you to catch this. She's a young woman in a society that deeply values masculine wisdom. That was the bee's knees, to be a male elder and thought to be wise. Like if God was going to do anything important, it was probably going to come through some wise male. If God was going to speak to anybody, it would probably be one of those guys at the gates, you know, debating ancient theology, a rabbi, a philosopher, you know, somebody like that. But what we can say about Mary, and what I want to say a bit more about, is we can maybe begin to describe the internal soil from which this sort of automatic response came. So I just want you to think with me for a moment, what do you suppose would be the interior reality of someone who could say, I take this disruption in my life and I become a willing, active participant in it? Well, I would first just say God. And then to Mary, obviously God is real. And then obviously God is up to something. He's doing something. She was the kind of person who was able to hear his voice and was grateful and humble. So what if we were to take serious this little journey we've been on the last 4 weeks of learning to say no to the culture of now, to say yes to the revolution implicit in Advent? What if instead of trying to cultivate a life in which you had pseudo control, what if you tried to cultivate gratefulness instead of control? What if you tried to actually proactively cultivate humility instead of control? How do you suppose that might shape one's interior life? And so Mary has this kind of interior life that allows her to be the model cooperative friend of God. She's an active, creative partner. She's kind of a willing instrument, but not in a utilitarian way, but in a highly relational way. And I know what happens, that we want control because it feels intuitively right. We're so tired. I can't let these external forces continue to drive me out of control. I'm exhausted. I have to find some control. Or I'm frustrated by my family or my workmates, and I've got to find a way to control. I'm beginning to feel overwhelmed with sadness and feeling a little depressed. I got to find some control. I'm feeling a bit anxious. I got to find some control. I'm feeling like I have these big unmet needs in my life. I've got to find some control. I get it. That is a 100% human experience. Everybody experiences that one way or another. And what that alerts us to is Mary's problem. You are incapable of producing an inner womb that can bear humility, generosity, kindness, goodness, patience. All of us are virgins in that sense. There's nothing alive in our womb, and there's no capacity for that to happen, for we have not known a man until you begin to know a man, and you say, birth within me. I choose to lay aside the cultivation of control, and I choose to be a willing partner with God the Holy Spirit, cultivating within me, partnering with the Spirit for the fruit of the Spirit to be born in me. I choose. As a virgin, incapable of bearing anything. As a virgin, bear anything. It's biological chaos. It can't happen. And so this text just sits before us, inviting us. You hear the invitation really in the words of Gabriel, where he comforts Mary by saying, but Mary, this isn't the whole story. For our readings this morning, remember the psalm. Remember God's steadfast love and faithfulness. Remember how God established covenant with you and your people, and how God, even through all the ups and downs of Jewish history, has remained with you, and he in this hour will strengthen you. That's why we read that psalm in Advent. It connects Mary to this big story. And then, we don't have time to say much about Romans this morning, but I can just tell you this. Romans opens with a big shout about God. And then Romans closes with this benediction, which is a big shout about God, where again, Paul might want to say to Mary, I know this is an anachronism, but Paul might want to say to Mary, from this benediction in Romans, hey, remember, Mary, God's able and wise. That's the difference-making reality into which you're being invited. God can establish you. God can establish your life. He's completely trustworthy, as the text says. And then I want you to hear this. Mary, what Paul could have said, Mary, God actually anticipated you. And for us, God anticipated Gentiles. People like us coming into this story. And deliberately beginning to say no to our pseudo, our make-believe, sort of good enough, pseudo-controlled life. And to say, ollie, ollie, income free. To the kind of life you can have that's marked by the steadfast, covenant, faithful love of God. And then if you have it in front of you, look at your Romans text. And you see maybe some sort of mature thinking about one might see in Mary, that God anticipated you Gentiles coming into this story like Mary into the obedience that comes through faith. And I just want to invite you to think this morning for a moment that a life of pseudo self-control is actually antithetical to the obedience that comes through faith. And that, or if you want to think of it differently, obedience that comes through faith cannot grow in the soil that's marked by pseudo self-control. So a week or so ago, I want to end this Advent series by saying one more bit here. A week or so ago, I brought up the Luddites. And I could see a few of you looking at each other and quickly using your smartphone. Siri, what is a Luddite? So the Luddites aren't probably what you think you are. I think they were. Weren't nerdy people who are just sort of down on technological advances. The Luddites were in the early 1800s, and they were textile artisans. And the Industrial Revolution was beginning to bring these huge machines into place that was displacing wide swaths of humanity. Wide swaths of knowledge and ability that was just being pushed to the margins of society. So the Luddites of a couple hundred years ago weren't anti-technology in the way you might think about it. They were pro-human. They were very much pro-human. They've become sort of a snappy little way to talk about those of us who are nervous about all the machines of the last couple hundred years. But that snappy little thing doesn't actually comport to reality so much. Now, there are Neo-Luddites today. There are actually Luddites today that call themselves Neo-Luddites who really do want to just completely separate themselves from human society. But I just want to suggest to you, and in this moment would say, you know, follow me as I follow Christ, as you will. But what I want to say to you today, that it is not our calling to become a Luddite, and it won't work. We are not haters of this culture. Here's what I want to suggest to you for our future together. We are spiritual realists. Which is simply to say, these devices are here and they're not going away. In that sense, the Luddites lost. They got their butts thoroughly kicked and have for 200 years as the Industrial Revolution became things that they could have never imagined. And it's not stopped, and it's going to stop. Do you know now that there are 1.2 million apps that you can download on this? And I'm sure that number is bigger because the number I saw was a few months old. Go on the App Store, 1.2 million apps. And as many as 60,000 apps are added per month. And that rate is growing. You know Nielsen, the people who, you know, study who watches TV and radio and they rate things, you know the Nielsen? So Nielsen has recently said that people now spend more than 30 hours a month on apps, connected to an app. And that each person has an average of 29 apps. So I think the better thing for us to do is to just think, how should we live now? We don't live before 1811. How should we live now? And I want to say we see something of the answer to that in Mary. Our calling is to be alert, to be aware, to be loyal, to have that kind of true fidelity, pure fidelity, that kind of commitment and yielding that we see in Mary. And to the degree that these technological advances can help us do that, that's fine. So like my phone tells me, I've been speaking for 22 minutes and 55 seconds. I'm glad I have this up here every week. It keeps me under 25 minutes. To the degree that's helpful to me, great, fine. But what we're called to do is live alert Sabbath lives. And I guess the last illustration I'd want to leave you with for this Advent thing is this. You know, we have a virtuoso musician with us this morning, at least one. Bobby could tell us that there is no music without rests. Rests make music. Music as you know it today would not be music as you know it without rests. Metered rests. They actually make music what it is. And my hope for these 4 weeks of Advent is that you would come to actually believe somewhere deep in your life that your life cannot be human as it was intended in the image of God without rest. In the same way rests make music, rest makes a human life and gives us the kind of capability in which we can actually even hear or follow God. When the rests are all gone, when technologies of all kinds fill all of our spaces, and when the workplace continues to fill all of our spaces, it drives out contemplation. It banishes curiosity. It removes imagination and makes dreaming almost impossible. So in this quiet moment, what if we were to wonder together, thinking first, as Paul taught us this morning, that God is wise and God is able. And that he sees the incapacity in our spiritual womb, he sees our virginness, but nevertheless invites us into his story. So I just want to leave you this morning to wonder, to what part of your life might you say this morning, behold, I am a servant of the Lord. Let it be unto me according to his word. Amen.